100,000 different abilities to do one work at the same time.
Yeah.
With one goal.
That's very eloquently put. Thank you.
And you've, of course, we are going to continue this.
Yeah, yeah. And we're
very significant.
I hope you've enjoyed it, the debate so far and the discussion that we've had about the Imam. But certainly, there is so much to talk about here. I mean, we're at the tip of the iceberg. We're just scraping the surface.
And we are learning on this. Every single of us, we are learning.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully, in the next session, we're going to go into more depth about how Imam Khomeini redefined,
God willing, we'll do
all these different aspects and sciences through his personality in the 20th century. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Light. A hotel in a ski resort in Kashmir has come up with a creative idea to keep its visitors warm and amused in the winter. The Kalahoy Green Heights has an igloo cafe where tourists can enjoy hot drinks and food in sub-zero temperatures. All the tables in the Eskimo-style cafe are made of ice and snow. As many as 16 people can sit and chill out in the igloo at any given time. The icy cafe is 25 feet around. It has elements of local architecture like an arched door and patterns on the curved walls.
A Russian firm has developed a flying taxi in an attempt to solve the problem of transportation in megacities. According to HoverSurf company, testing the aircraft is now in the final stages. If successful, the drone taxi will go into mass production at the end of 2021. Special runways are not required as the vehicle is as big as a normal car and can land on a parking lot. Designers say it's capable of carrying two people or up to 300 kilograms of cargo.
The prototype of this flying machine will soon turn into a social device that we're going to build in 2021. And thus, all the technologies that we have already built will be applied to this machine. The car will fly with a new type of engine that is installed here.
The flying taxi can reach an altitude of 150 meters and develop a speed of up to 200 kilometers per hour. The company says a flight with air taxi will cost around 27 cents per kilometer. The name Afghanistan may remind many people across the world of some bad news of war, violence and poverty. This is mainly due to the war in Afghanistan, which has been going on for over the past decades. Yet, there are some interesting stories about Afghanistan, its people and their traditions and customs, such as Afghans' food culture. Amin Alami has more in this report.
When it comes to cooking and traditional dishes, Afghans have a lot to say. First of all, this is important to know that meat and rice are inseparable parts of Afghans' food culture.
Afghan traditional dishes like qabili, kebab, karai, mantu, ashak, bulani and dugh are the some you can find available in restaurants, mainly serving traditional delicacies. Each one of these represents the food culture of specific tribes and ethnic groups.
Let's see what the manager of this restaurant has to say about some popular local dishes in Afghanistan.
When you want to talk about traditional foods of Afghanistan, you need to test different dishes that are, of course, very delicious. For instance, qabili is a mixture of rice, carrot, cuisine, and lamb meat. Northern Afghanistan is a home to this delicious food, while Western Herat province is well known for its delicious khichdi.
There are some key factors which should be taken into consideration when talking about Afghan food culture. As Afghans themselves say, their food is highly organic. They believe the food culture has made Afghans' bodies much stronger than those who do not have organic meals in their food culture.
We can't leave out meat from cooking. Additionally, our food culture is based on using organic products. This has even helped us have a stronger body.
As there is a wide variety of delicious dishes here, the good news is that the prices are not high. For example, you can serve a complete lunch menu at one of the top restaurants in Kabul by spending at most $15.
If you compare food prices in Afghanistan and other countries, you will find out that you can have the best dish in a top restaurant in Afghanistan by paying less than $20. The quality of food in our country is also better.
As observers say, Afghanistan has many capabilities and interesting attractions to be truly introduced for the globe if the war and politics allow this wounded land to breathe. Sayed Amin Alimi, Kabul.
After nearly 3 years of conservation efforts, a group of newborn leaf monkeys have been recently spotted in southwest China. The rare monkeys, which fall under China's first-class national protection program, were spotted earlier this month in Mangshi City in Yunnan province. The baby monkeys sport golden fur, which will gradually turn gray when they are about 3 months old. Forest keepers have been noting an increase in the number of monkeys and expect their population to continue growing as biodiversity is improving.
Since the beginning of this year, we have spotted 11 little golden monkeys and several pregnant adult monkeys. It can be estimated that the number of these golden newborns will increase to around 20 by April.
Leaf monkeys are spread across western Yunnan as well as in eastern and northern Myanmar. Over the past few years, Yunnan's local government has strengthened protection for the animals. It's estimated there are now approximately 400 leaf monkeys in Mangshi.
A French Swiss artist spray paints a huge fresco on the grounds of Cape Town as part of a global project aimed at fostering unity in a polarized world. The 31-year-old artist tries to convey his message of togetherness in his movement called Beyond Walls. The project consists of frescoes depicting two hands clasping each other's forearms around the world. South Africa's Cape Town represents an essential step of the project due to its history marked by apartheid. The self-taught artist says he wants to create the biggest human chain in the world, and Cape Town is his ninth step.
Because for me, I really trust that it's only together that humanity can respond to the biggest challenge of our time. And this is this message that I want to do by making huge fresco with biodegradable paint directly on the grass. It is a worldwide project, and the idea is to create the biggest human chain to speak about togetherness. And today in Cape Town, this is the ninth step of this project.
Saib uses paint made out of charcoal, chalk, water, and milk proteins to create his art, making it eco-friendly. He was also named one of the most influential young artists by Forbes magazine for his art, which is best viewed from aerial footage. His temporary biodegradable images have been previously painted on lawns in 8 cities, including Paris, Andorra, Geneva, Berlin, Ouagadougou, and Istanbul.
Scientists have discovered a 20-million-year-old fossilized tree with intact branches and roots on the Greek island of Lesbos. The 19-meter-long tree was found near a petrified forest formed millions of years ago by a volcanic eruption. A thick layer of ash had preserved the tree. Since excavations began 25 years ago, this is the first time a tree in such proper condition has been uncovered in the area. Experts have been studying the unique forest to gather information of plants and animals and to reconstruct the ecosystem that existed 20 million years ago.
In Slovenia, two climbers have dared to scale Europe's tallest chimney. Janja Granbrej and Damen Skofic managed to complete the challenge in 7 hours and 32 minutes. They describe the experience as the most difficult one in their professional lives. The 360-meter-high tower at the Trebaville Power Station is located in eastern Slovenia. It is known as the world's longest artificial multi-pitch climbing route.
Oh, isn't this sweet? A baby panda gluing to a zookeeper's leg has grabbed attention on social media, with her video receiving at least 4 million hits on YouTube alone. 6 months old Fu Bao lives in a South Korean zoo. Her video went viral, showing the cub gripping her keeper's leg during a regular checkup. The cute panda refused to let the keeper go, even when he tried to walk away. Fu Bao is the first giant panda born in South Korea. Her parents arrived in the country in 2016 as part of China's panda diplomacy. Fu Bao has received enormous attention since her birth, with her videos posted on the zoo's social media. Elephants at a zoo in the U.S. state of Arizona have enjoyed a rare snowy day, romping joyfully under the white flurry. While most of animals in Ride Park Zoo cozied up in the warmth, the elephants could not resist the snowfall in the sun-kissed state. They stayed out, with baby elephants splashing in their enclosure's pond and rolling in the mud. The baby elephants saw the snowfall for the first time in their life. Frosty flakes made their way to Arizona on Tuesday. That was a surprise for many in the U.S. West, which is plagued by drought.
That's it for the light. Thank you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Major General William Walker said that leaders at the Pentagon restricted his authority to take preventive steps to address concerns about former President Donald Trump's supporters, as the possibility for violence in Washington, D.C. became known well before the rally that took place outside the White House that day. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, DC National Guard Chief Says Pentagon Restricted Quick Response to Capitol Attack. Here's the details of this article. The commanding general of the District of Columbia National Guard said recently that his agency was restricted by the Pentagon from taking actions that could have allowed for a greater security presence or faster reaction time on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol building ahead of the attacks that took place there on January 6 by pro-Trump loyalists. Major General William Walker said that leaders at the Pentagon restricted his authority to take preventive steps to address concerns about former President Donald Trump's supporters as the possibility for violence in Washington, D.C. became known well before the rally that took place outside the White House that day. Local National Guard commanders usually have the ability to take responsive actions when lives are at risk or significant property damage is possible in certain scenarios, particularly when it isn't possible to obtain approval quickly. But Walker, speaking ahead of testimony in a House committee hearing, said to take place behind closed doors, said he was restricted from being able to respond preemptively when Trump loyalists besieged the Capitol. All military commanders normally have immediate response authority to protect property, life, and in my case, federal functions, federal property, and life. But in this instance, I did not have that authority, Walker explained in an interview with the Washington Post. A detailed timeline of the day's events shows that the Pentagon took about an hour and a half to approve requests for the National Guard to respond to the Capitol breach, according to reporting from the Hill. Former Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy also told the Post that the restrictions from the Pentagon were put in place due to criticism the Department of Defense had received for the way in which they had handled Black Lives Matter protests last summer. After June, the authorities were pulled back up to the Secretary of Defense office. Anytime we would employ troops and guardsmen in the city, you had to go through a rigorous process, McCarthy said. Many have noted that there were significant differences in police and military presence and actions during the Capitol breach of January 6 compared to the Black Lives Matter protests that took place over the summer, which received a significantly swifter preemptive security response. President Joe Biden has himself criticized the wide discrepancies in how each event was approached earlier this month. No one can tell me that if it had been a group of Black Lives Matter protesters yesterday, that they wouldn't have been treated very differently than the mob that stormed the Capitol, Biden wrote in a tweet on January 7th. We all know that's true, and it's unacceptable. The D.C. National Guard wasn't the only agency that didn't prepare enough for the Capitol breach that took place on January 6th, which resulted in the death of five individuals. The U.S. Capitol Police were also slow to react or even prepare for the possibility of violence on that day. According to several accounts from officers who spoke to the Associated Press earlier this month about the event, in those same closed-doors House hearings recently, Uganda Pittman, the acting chief of the Capitol Police, acknowledged that the agency had been aware of a strong potential for violence that day and apologized directly to Congress for the ill-prepared response. I am here to offer my sincerest apologies on behalf of the department, Pittman, who was not in charge of Capitol Police on January 6th, said. The National Guard plans to keep 5,000 troops in Washington, D.C. through mid-March because of the continued threats of violence that exist from far-right groups and ardent Trump supporters who refuse to accept the results of November presidential election based on claims of election fraud that the former president continues to push. Many believe Trump is to blame for having instigated his loyalists to attack the Capitol. Trump invited his most ardent supporters to descend on Washington, D.C. in several tweets prior to January 6, including in one post he made on December 20, where he said the rally he'd be hosting would be wild. During the event itself, Trump continued to peddle false claims of fraud and used language that appeared to motivate his loyalists to attack the Capitol, including at one point saying to his supporters that he would never take back country with weakness. We'll be right back.
aperture.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. This is Aperture. In response to the sustained and increasingly visible violence against black communities in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement took shape. The movement campaigns against police violence and systematic racism towards African Americans. People from all walks of life in the Black Lives Matter campaign regularly protests police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Went unconscious.
Cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
His death not being called a homicide.
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
In riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles, but protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight.
The
the significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance, but I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
we did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he was actually, he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us, it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at a given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive. And the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, you know, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, yeah. Really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens with the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah, absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Garner in a chokehold. Garner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Garner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Garner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Garner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why. You know, I was screaming at the the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being
killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we've seen on the TV, on the computer to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I've never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Gardner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Gardner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnbeck, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes the roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if black lives matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
There are these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia repeatedly expressed support for assassinating leading Democrats. A review of hundreds of posts and comments on Greene's Facebook page revealed that, in addition to posting far-right conspiracy theories about the deep state and Democrats, the Georgia congresswoman also engaged with people who called for executing prominent Democratic politicians. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading, Report Reveals Racist Conspiracy Theories. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene showed support for murdering Democrats. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a freshman Republican lawmaker, prolific bigot and conspiracy theorist, and a staunch backer of former President Donald Trump, repeatedly showed support online for executing prominent Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, former President Barack Obama, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, CNN reported recently. Greene, who represents Georgia's 14th congressional district, in January 2019, liked a Facebook comment asserting that a bullet to the head would be quicker to oust Pelosi from the House speakership. In April 2018, she responded to a Facebook post asking, "If we get to hang Obama and Clinton over their support for the Iran nuclear deal by saying the stage is being set and players are being put in place." "We must be patient," wrote Greene. "This must be done perfectly, or liberal judges would let them off." Greene also liked Facebook comments supporting the assassination of FBI agents who were purportedly part of deep state opposition to Trump. Recently, Greene tweeted that fake news, CNN is writing yet another hit piece on me focusing my time before running for political office. Over the years, I've had teams of people manage my pages, she wrote. Many posts have been liked, many posts have been shared. Some did not represent my views, especially the ones that CNN is about to spread across the internet. Green's views, however, have been clearly on display in recent years. These include, but are not limited to, the following. Being a vocal supporter of conspiracy theories, including Pizzagate and QAnon, which allege in part that prominent Democrats are leaders of a satanic cult of cannibalistic pedophile sex traffickers seeking to destroy Trump. Agreeing that massacres, including those at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand, were false flag operations meant to erode Second Amendment rights. Expressing anti-Semitic and Islamophobic views. Expressing anti-black and white supremacist views, including the opinion that the most mistreated group of people in the United States today are white males. Spousing 9/11 truther conspiracies, and finally claiming that Clinton has murdered her political enemies. An incessant twitter of lies and conspiracy theories, Green, who won 74.7% of the vote in her 2020 House race, is also known for menacing Democrats in Congress, including the so-called Squad. While campaigning last year, Green posted an image of her holding a gun alongside Squad members, with a caption reading, "We need strong conservative Christians to go on the offense against these socialists who want to rip our country apart." Green was one of the 147 Republican lawmakers who attempt to overturn President Joe Biden's Electoral College victory, helping to incite the deadly January 6 pro-Trump terror attack on the U.S. Capitol. Squad member Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who took refuge in a secure room with maskless coronavirus-spreading Republican lawmakers, including Green, during the Capitol siege, said afterwards that she had feared for her life due to QAnon and white supremacist sympathizers, and frankly, white supremacist members of Congress in that extraction point who I know and who I had felt would disclose my location, who would create opportunities to allow me to be hurt, kidnapped, unquote.
Around the world with reporters.
The American aggression and the blockade on Yemen are terrorist crimes is the motto of a press conference held by the Intisaf Organization for the Rights of Women and the Children. The conference highlighted the crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemeni children and women with American support.
The crimes and violations committed by the U.S. against the people of Yemen are too many and cannot be counted. There is, for example, the crime of targeting children in Dahyan in Sada, and the crime of targeting women in weddings in Wajiha, Ahrab, and Samban, and these are war crimes for sure.
The Minister of Human Rights said that designating Ansarullah as a terrorist organization confirms that the American participation went beyond arms sales, military and logistical support, and reached providing political cover and justifying the crimes of its Saudi ally.
The classification of Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization is an American green light for Saudi Arabia to continue its aggression against Yemen, and also to feed terrorism and terrorist groups, as happened in Al-Baidah, when the Yemeni army found weapons with the logo of the United States Agency for International Development, and also for the sake of covering and evading its crimes in Yemen.
The Saudi war on Yemen has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions of others. The country is suffering from a humanitarian situation that was described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Yemenis unanimously agree that the U.S. is a major complicit in the war crimes committed against Yemeni children and women, which necessitates placing its name on the top of the list of states sponsoring terrorism. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
The UK has used slogans to raise awareness during the pandemic. One of its most popular is Stay Home, Protect the NHS, Save Lives. Some government messaging has been comforting as well as informative, but it's become more and more intense, with TV ads showing people dying and incessant radio ads claiming joggers and people working outdoors are highly likely to have the disease.
Stick to the rules. If you bend the rules, people will die. Stay home, protect the NHS.
The government is now under pressure to pull this ad after Number 10 was condemned by MPs and public health experts for spreading false information. Parents worry they will affect their children. Surely this messaging could be really damaging to vulnerable people and is irresponsible. Telling five-year-olds if someone bends the rules, people will die seems really inappropriate. We need sensible messaging. They should not be saying people will die. We are heading for a huge mental health crisis in this country. And experts agree. 10 of the UK's top experts in child health say anxiety, self-harm, and suicidal thoughts have reached frightening levels among children. Pediatricians are urging the government to reopen schools or risk a calamitous impact on children's mental health. Boris Johnson says he understands the concerns surrounding the mental health of young people, but it all relies on the vaccine.
If we achieve our target of vaccinating everyone in the four most vulnerable groups with their first dose by the 15th of February, and every passing day sees more progress towards that goal, then those groups that have developed immunity from the virus about 3 weeks later, that is by the 8th of March, we hope it will therefore be safe to begin the reopening of schools from Monday the 8th of March.
Adults themselves are struggling. There has been a surge in people afraid to leave the house. Alcohol consumption has gone up, and helplines say calls regarding domestic abuse have increased many times over.
Health services in the UK say as a result of the pandemic, at least 10 million people are going to need some form of mental health support. And with no real end in sight for the lockdowns and the virus itself, more and more people are losing hope. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iranian cultural figures, artists from different countries, as well as envoys of the foreign states, attended the closing ceremony of the biggest calligraphy event, which was held in Jundi Shapur Library west of Tehran. Some of the artists also performed calligraphy live while the audience could watch their expertise. The exhibition aims at convening countries which have olden historical civilizations. Artworks from Silk Road countries, including Pakistan, Egypt, India, Tajikistan, Iraq, Tunisia, Algeria, and Afghanistan, were put on show both virtually and also physically with limited number of visitors due to the pandemic. The organizers noted that as the works were in different languages, it was not possible to judge them. Iranian National Commission for UNESCO decided to hold this festival to enhance cultural proximity among countries. We started the preliminary phases since 1.5 years ago. Almost 1,000 works from different countries were received by the Secretariat. As the works were written in different languages, we could not judge them. So we decided to choose the winners randomly. Veteran calligraphers also noted that calligraphy is a heritage that must always be preserved.
Calligraphy works by 203 artists from 30 countries have been showcased in the exhibition, which officially opened on January 20th
in the northeastern Iranian city of Mashhad, Humayun Abadi, Tehran.
With the new U.S. administration taking the helm at the White House, many express optimism that the 2015 Iran nuclear deal will be back on the board. But comments by U.S. officials have raised doubts over the optimism. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington will meet its commitments on the